from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer. And for the rest of this hour, we're talking about criticism aimed at management of the San Francisco waterfront. The Port of San Francisco owns and leases some of the most valuable property in the Bay Area. It's also been at the center of recent controversies over development, the America's Cup yacht race, and a proposal now abandoned to build a grand arena at Piers 3032 for the Golden State Warriors. Now, a report from the San Francisco civil grand jury criticizes the port's management and what it calls the undue influence of developers close to the mayor who have undue influence on decision-making at the expense of the public's interest. Joining me now to talk about the report and its findings, Elena Schmidt, foreperson for the San Francisco civil grand jury. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you very much.
And also here, David Hoym. He was the port committee chair for the grand jury. Welcome to you as well.
Thank you for having us.
Let me begin by asking you, what is a civil grand jury? I was mentioning this report to somebody the other day here at KQED, and they said, who are they?
That's absolutely right, and we get that question. I've gotten that question for a year from almost everybody that I've talked to about when they say, what are you doing? And I say, I'm on the civil grand jury, and they inevitably say, who are you indicting? So there's a big difference between the indictment grand jury, which is dealt with through the district attorney, and the civil grand jury. We basically, it is in California's constitution, and our job is to represent the citizens and to look into local government and investigate particular issues and see if we can make any recommendations that would make local government a little bit more efficient.
And these are appointed by who? You are appointed by who?
They ask, it's the Superior Court. The Superior Court asks for volunteers during the late spring. And then they interview those volunteers and choose 30 at random. And of those 30, it is, and so they're chosen at random, put on a list. They choose 19 to sit, and the foreperson is the only one who's appointed by the presiding judge.
I see. And then, David, you were on this as well, one of the 19. Have you done this before?
No, I never have, but I've wanted to do it for years, and I never had the time because it does take a big commitment.
Yeah. And I want to say in the interest of full disclosure that that you folks asked me this week to meet with you, to sit down, just to talk about how to deal with the media because you're citizen volunteers. We did not discuss the report. I didn't know even what the report was about. We really just talked about how to deal with your jobs as jurors, as grand jurors, and what to expect.
So, Scott, could I add just one more thing?
Yeah, sure.
That I think is important to keep in mind. We take an oath, and we have to operate under strict confidentiality. So we the jurors cannot say who appeared before us, either in the report or in any conversations about the report. And so the only thing that we can really talk about is what's public, which is the report itself.
And the report is called The Port of San Francisco, Caught Between Public Trust and Private Dollars. David Hoym, what does that mean?
Well, the public trust is actually an ancient doctrine dating back to the Byzantine Empire, the 8th century, enshrined in Roman law through the Magna Carta, and has appeared in various Supreme Court cases. And essentially what it says is that the seashore, the land, and the air belongs to the public and should be administered for the benefit of the public. And it's, you know, this is a historical perspective going back, to the 8th century. So we're talking about 1,300 years.
But in terms of this report and your recommendations, your findings, why did you choose to say caught between public trust and private dollars?
Okay, well, the primary doctrine governing the port is this administration of the public trust, but it has in the past few years been the subject of great input of money from private developers, and the attempt is to use those private developers' monies to help the port finance its infrastructure repairs. But in the process of doing that, the dollars are not directed always for the benefit of the public or
directly.
Give
an example of that.
Well, for instance, the 8 Washington Street project was obviously shot down by the voters 2-1, yet developers have been pushing that for years and years and years. The mayor was behind it strongly. The Warriors Arena was going to be the mayor's legacy project that was backed by a multi-hundred million dollar, $200 million plus project or billion, whatever it was that the Warriors were going to put into it. So all this money was influencing the decision, which the voters were not in favor of.
And Elena, the report alleges that it was done without adequate public notice and input. The port, by the way, who we invited to be here, declined to be here, but they issued a statement, and I won't read it all, but Monique Moyer, the port executive director, said the port always welcomes input and ideas that will help us operate more effectively from the public. The waterfront plan is founded on the principle of public involvement, which port staff pursues with each major development opportunity along the public's waterfront. And then a spokesman for the mayor, Christine Falvey, said there is more transparency, public input, and public process when it comes to San Francisco's world-class waterfront than at any time in our city's history. So, Elena Schmidt, your report says what? That's not accurate?
I think what we're trying to say is it's not only a question of who's sitting at the table, but what we're looking at is who is not sitting at the table. And what we found when we looked at the big development projects of the past few years is that the citizens were not at the table. That we use as an example, the Pier 70 development. And when we looked at Pier 70, they had tremendous public outreach. They had hundreds of community meetings.
About 1,000.
And so that when they had the meetings and the community understood what they were doing and they realized that they were listening to the communities was being listened to, then they get the support of the community. When you look at 8 Washington or the Golden State Warriors Stadium or that kind of stuff, there was controversy because the community was not involved from the beginning.
The port is basically sort of a land management, a real estate management company, in a sense, right? Their leases. I mean, it's not like they're running. They're not running the container operations or that sort of thing. So, in a sense, isn't this what they have to do? They have to maximize the value, the income from the land that they have.
Well, the way it works is there is an operating budget of $80+ million, and the revenue from the rentals, the restaurants, fishing piers, et cetera, is sufficient to provide operating revenue. But the infrastructure, the ports, the piers themselves, buildings, historical buildings and such are deteriorating, and the cost of repairs is almost $1.6 billion. And that's where they don't have the money. So they are forced to go to private developers to get this money. But there's ways to go about it that are better. Elena mentioned the Pier 70 project. And just as an example of how responsive the developers of Pier 70 have been since the Prop B initiative passed, they have already said that they're lowering the heights of their proposed buildings. They're being very responsive. Then on the other hand, you look at Mayor Lee and the Lucas Museum. And he has suggested to Lucas that they can use Seawall Lot 330, which is across the street from what was going to be part of the Warriors project, and said he could put his museum there. Well, I don't recall any consultation with anybody else happening that he's just offered this piece of land to them. And not saying whether it's a good or a bad idea, but it's just that the process is deficient and at least not sufficient as it has been in other instances.
Talking about a new civil grand jury report focusing on the port of San Francisco, and our guests this half hour, Elena Schmidt, foreperson of the civil grand jury, and David Hoym, who is the port committee chair. If you want to join us, the number to call is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum@kqed.org. You also, Elena, in this report, have quite a bit of praise for the port. You mentioned the things that they've done well over the past couple of decades, including ferry building restoration. All these things happened after the Embarcadero Freeway came down in 1991, the new Exploratorium on the waterfront, AT&T Park even. So where did it go wrong?
It's not a question of going wrong, and let's be very clear. I think that what the grand jury is saying is that when you look at the port and the totality of everything that's there in that 7.5 miles that they're responsible for, they have done some very strong, very publicly oriented things. Everything that we mentioned were things that are going to help either on the maritime side or for public access. Those are the kinds of things that I think the citizens support. I think when you go down and you go for a walk on the port, you can see how much the citizens appreciate what's there. What we're concerned with is when the shrinking amount of very prime real estate is now being talked about for private dollars rather than for public enjoyment or that kind of thing.
You talk in the report about the America's Cup event and say that that there was a total cost to the port of $11.5 million to the city and the port, that the organizers were allowed to use piers for free, but that the city got no revenue sharing in return. But didn't the city, David Hoym, also get sales tax and revenue, hotel tax revenue, and great publicity that I'm sure the Convention and Visitors Bureau would have liked?
Well, there was that level of publicity, and this was not a part of our report, so I'm not sure, you know, how accurate it is, but my understanding was that hotel occupancy was not necessarily significantly higher than a normal tourist season. The port had to pay for a lot of things. And what was troubling about the whole America's Cup thing from the beginning was the initial, and again, back to the mayor's involvement in it, the initial thrust was for the for Allison Group to be given Pier 30 or 32, just to be handed
it
to
them. Larry Allison from Oracle.
Right.
Yeah.
And the Board of Supervisors stepped in and stopped that because the cost of the land was so high that they had to approve it. They didn't approve it. But again, this is an example of the mayor pushing things through that were not necessarily in the best public interest, but would further some sort of project aim.
Elena Schmidt, you know, there's a criticism here in the report of, you know, the port being hampered by politics. Hasn't that always been the case? I mean, there's always been politics around the San Francisco port and pretty much every tree and block in the city. I mean, how is this different from what we've seen in the past around the port in particular?
Again, I think from my point of view, what I would say is it's now much more focused, much higher dollars. And absolutely, you're right in terms of there's always politics. That's part of what it is. But part of the way that the politics can be diffused or made a little less confrontational is by including more into the discussion, including more people into the discussion, making sure that all groups are represented and that kind of thing.
Although, David Hoym, you know, in San Francisco, it seems that in general there's so much public input. Community groups are very involved. It's a very democratic with a small C and a big D and a small D city. And we just saw in June the voters passed Prop B, which is going to give the public now the right to weigh in on projects that exceed existing height limits. So, I mean, is it possible that too much public input is too much public input possible, do you think? Can that hamper things?
Well, it's definitely a possibility, especially when you start looking at the trade-offs for development versus housing, affordable housing, tax revenue, the money needed by the port for rebuild their infrastructure. So it can get very complicated issue when you're talking about a project, say the Pier 40, 48, the Giants parking lot, Mission Rock, or whatever it's called, and look at these types of projects and to evaluate the trade-offs of the benefit to the city versus, you know, loss of views or congestion impacting transportation. It's very complex, and it's possible that it could be that a lot of voters may not really understand all the ramifications. So,
Elena Schmidt, what would you add to that?
I think that it's a question of the context in which the public input is being given. I think when you're legislating something that's much more difficult versus sitting down before the project is being completely developed and working with the community in that time space is a much easier, much more elastic time space. So that if you're now talking about having the developers having to go to the vote it's a much more restrictive time space in terms of how the people can interact, and therefore you're going to get more difficulties.
Talking with Elena Schmidt and David Hoym from the San Francisco Civil Grand Jury and their first report of several, I believe, that are coming out over the next week or so, this one on the port of San Francisco. If you'd like to join our conversation, give us a call at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. You can also email us. It's forum at kqed.org or send us a comment on our Facebook page. Here's a comment from one listener who writes, the usurpation of San Francisco's port is nothing different from the same curve that cedes our public space to private hands. This is a parallel between the spoliation of public transit space by Google buses and the port space by developers who will extract cash till blood comes out and then take off, leaving behind a devastated San Francisco. And we hear that a lot, Elena Schmidt, and I don't want to get too far afield from the substance of your report here, but it seems to me that many cities would love to have the problems that San Francisco has with developers wanting to build not only on the waterfront but all across the city. Is it a case of just too much of a good thing or lack of public process? What do you think?
I would take it in the other direction, which is that the port is a very precious resource and a very unique resource, and there isn't much developable space there anymore. And so now it becomes much more focused in terms of what's going on. So, you know, the rest of the city, you know, there are good plans going on in terms of where the growth can happen and all that kind of stuff. All we're concentrating on is the port and the realization of what little bit is left, and that we have to – one of the things that we talk about is, you know, the port did a good job in developing their maritime land use plan. Took a long time, took lots of community input, and it's been there for 17 years, and it's time to begin to look at that again, although we're only saying they should update it, not start from scratch. But in updating it, they need to look at the maritime use as well.
And David Hoym, what does that mean, maritime uses? I mean, what do you have in mind? What do you recommend?
Well, there's two definitions for maritime use. One is traditionally you would think boats, but then the waterfront land use plan as it exists and will probably continue to define maritime use as anything that brings people to the water, which is fine, which would explain why the Exploratorium is considered maritime land use. The port is restricted to only maritime-related activities, but the idea of Pier 39 brings people to visit the waterfront. The restaurants do, museums, those are all considered maritime use. But we'd also like to see more of a focus, and the port, too, would like to see more of a focus on actual ships. So as a result of that—
When you say actual ships, I mean, but beyond shipping meaning— like
freight.
Freight.
Yeah.
Is that realistic?
To some degree.
The Port of Oakland is doing that quite well.
Right.
Don't they have the market cornered?
And that's all containerized, but not all freight is containerized. There's a category of freight called break bulk, which is traditional, where it would be offloaded by essentially cranes in pieces. And I know the port is looking at the southern waterfront area, Pier 9098, to increase shipping there, used to bring in some iron ore and things. And they're actively pursuing to expand that use and the maritime use, and also there's an expansion of the ferry piers by the ferry building to increase ferry traffic. So those are uses that you're going to see. Possibly water taxis might become more prevalent.
All right. Let's go to the phones. I had a call from somebody in Tennessee. I guess that call's gone. Let's see if Lee in San Francisco is with us. Good morning.
Thank you. A perfect example of the port ignoring community input. The Asian neighborhood design, together with a large number of community organizations, spent a great deal of time putting together what we called a community vision for San Francisco's northeast waterfront. From the ferry building to the fisherman's wharf, included many parcels of open space, recreation, and development that would provide revenue for the port. We presented it before the port commission and the staff, and it's been totally ignored, but it's still on the table. This is the kind of example that we find doesn't fit for community input. Thank you.
You bet. Thanks for calling. And Elena Schmidt, speaking of the Port Commission, you also made a recommendation there. The mayor currently appoints all five port commissioners, and you're suggesting in this report that the mayor appoint three and that the board of supervisors appoint two. What would that accomplish?
Let me start first by saying that is a stretch recommendation. That would be tough to do because we'd have to work with the state legislature in order to be able to make that change, since it's the Burton Act that said that the mayor should appoint all five. And what we were after at that point is part of the underlying theme of the report, which is the Board of Supervisors is a little more accountable to the public than the mayor. And that
why is that?
When you
what makes you say that?
Because I think the process, or the way the process, as I understand it, is that if you're going to be appointed by the Board of Supervisors, you have to apply, you have to fill out an economic form so that your financials are known, you know where your conflicts are or not in conflicts, that your appointment is a public appointment. In other words, people can come and talk about your appointment so that the Board of Supervisors will get some input from the community about it. And then if they're appointed, then there's also the feeling that the public has someone they can turn to if there's some problem going on within the organization.
I think most city commissions are appointed fully by the mayor, if I'm not mistaken. Health Department, Department of Public Works, and right on down the list. Why should the port be different?
We looked at the land commissions, those commissions that looked at what's dealing with planning, with the land aspects. And those are split between the mayor and the Board of Supervisors.
You're not saying, though, that the board is insulated from politics.
No, not in the least.
Okay.
It's just you can get
a different
more
kind of
voices. More voices there, yes.
All right. Again, the number to call if you want to join us this half hour talking about the grand jury report on the Port of San Francisco, 866-733-6786. Let's go now to Tennessee. Matt is on the line. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks. What's going on in Tennessee this morning?
Oh, it's a hot, sunny day and humid here in Tennessee. Not like San Francisco.
No. Go ahead. What's on your mind?
No, I just wanted to bring up the point about the cruise ship industry. I had heard a while back, maybe it's been about 2 years, that there had been plans for a new terminal. I know the old terminal down there at Pier, I think it is 35, is a bit dilapidated and doesn't really accommodate ships very well. And I just wanted to hear, you know, where those plans were and your guest thoughts on the cruise ship industry coming into San Francisco and making a bigger economic impact there. That's all.
All right. Thanks for the call. David Horn.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, there is currently under construction a cruise ship terminal at Pier 27. It's very modern. It looks great. It's funded partially with a $30 million revenue bond, but I believe the cost is about, it's way more than that. But so cruise ships will be coming in there. However, the cruise ship industry is hampered by a federal statute from 1886 that prevents passenger ships from stopping at two consecutive U.S. ports unless it's a U.S. flagged vessel, which there are virtually none except one. Well, there's one in Hawaii. But so you can't have a cruise ship come from L.A. to San Francisco. They have to go to Mexico first or Canada first before they come to San Francisco. So that restricts the number of visits to about roughly around 50 a year. It's estimated that could triple if this were modified. It's a federal statute. That's another big stretch.
And I know the port in the past has taken a run at changing that.
Right, and there's a lot of pushback for that. However, there is, I believe on the East Coast, there is a exemption granted. And we're asking for a pilot program for an exemption to see if that will increase the traffic. The new cruise terminal will be severely underutilized. And so it will probably not be cost effective unless we can increase the traffic.
Got some email here. Let me read one from Chris, who writes, contrary to the impression created by your guest, the Warriors Arena project proposed to provide a new public open space on 60% of Piers 3032, where the BCDC SF Waterfront Special Area Plan, a plan that was the result of over a decade of public input, only requires 30%. By stopping the project, the public is left with no access to these piers. David Hoyne?
Well, it by its very nature was very controversial, and a great percentage of that open space was going to be on top of a 125-foot structure. So there was many people that were not in favor of such a large structure, and also the cost was prohibitive for the facility at that location because of the reinforcement of the existing pier required extensive work to support the weight of the arena. But yes, there was open space proposed, and the maritime use would be met by theoretically bringing people in to near the waterfront. However, the stadium, as opposed to AT&T Park, you're looking in at AT&T Park, you can actually see the water from it. So they were going to put big windows. There's another unique aspect of Pier 3032 is on the east end of it, is a huge deep water berth. It's 50 feet deep and 1,350 feet long. There are a total of five deep water berths in the pier. This one is unique because it does not require dredging. It's self-scouring, and it's very large. So they were going to use that to bring in ferries, I believe.
All right, let's see if I can squeeze another email in here. David writes, I was at a meeting recently where the South Bay Neighborhood Association decided to write a letter to George Lucas in support of his museum at Seawall Lot 330. While it is true that the mayor's people ran the meeting and had control of the information, they did convince neighborhood resident activists that the museum was a good idea. There were a few lone voices asking, why are we giving the land worth millions away? But they were ignored. Elena Schmidt, public process. It's great to have people involved and to have everyone heard and to listen and consider everyone's point of view. But in the end, someone has to make a decision, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's why we have elected officials.
And so this isn't a case of the people who, you know, weren't heard or who lost. This isn't a case of sour grapes.
Right. This is a case of let's just make sure everybody's as informed as we can be at this point. And so we did not look into the George Lucas Museum since that happened after the majority of our report was written. So we can't make very much comments about it. But it's a question of, you know, that's one case where, in fact, they are keeping people informed right from the get-go, it looks like.
And then just very, very quickly, you have more reports coming out starting when?
We hope to have one more, if not two more this week. And then the following week, we'll have some more.
All right. And you can't tell us what those topics are?
No, I'm sorry to say we can't.
All right. Elena Schmidt, foreperson, and David Hoym, committee chair of the San Francisco Civil Grand Jury. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us.
And I should mention that tonight on KQED Newsroom, Channel 9 at 8 o'clock with Tui Vu, we'll have much more about this topic. So tune in for that, if you would. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. For all of us here at KQED, I'm Scott Schaefer.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.